After 25 years in the fashion industry, I've realized that fashion is not really about the clothes, it's about the people. I'm Laura Van Root Poole, and this is What We Wore. Georgia Dant is pioneering a new chapter for fashion with her innovative brand, Marfa Stance. Her focus on function and style and creating seasonless garments defines what sustainable brands will look like in the future. Georgia Dant, I'm so excited to have you on the podcast and excited to be talking to you from you're in Jackson Hole.
Yep. I'm in a cabin in the heart of Jackson Hole, and it's very beautiful. So thank you for having me, Laura.
And you warned me earlier if there are some moose mating calls in the background.
Yeah, we'll acknowledge and ignore.
And you're there with a lot of friends of ours, the gals from Of Rare Origin and Miran Crosby, and you're there for
absolutely. I'm actually wearing Of Rare Origin right now. I bought it yesterday. Be my honey. I'm here with a bunch of amazing brands. We had a trunk show all together yesterday, which was really incredible. I've never done something like this before. So
it was
really fun. And also we're friends with Laline. They were there too. And
it was a whole
gaggle of us.
It's unusual actually, and really helpful, because I think a lot of times, especially, I mean, I think for me as an independent retailer, but I think for independent designers, you don't really have a lot of opportunities to be together and commiserate and sort of ask them their opinions about you're doing. And
last night we were sitting at dinner. We all had dinner afterwards as a celebration. And I looked around and I was just so happy to see this table of courageous women all together supporting each other. There was perhaps 30 of us.
Wow.
And I just felt such kind of, I don't know, an overwhelming thankfulness that we can all just actually share this experience rather than be in competition with each other. It's more that we're actually, there's a camaraderie between us, and we all bought from each other. We all support each other.
Yeah.
It's really
very
nice. And it's a huge therapy session, of course. Yes.
I think I'm right. I mean, I think your brand started during the pandemic. So I think
right before.
And so being able to be able to discuss things and like, am I crazy? Am I doing this right? Am I doing this wrong? I mean, that's really amazing.
Yes. And it's a journey as a sort of, you know, female founder doing this on my own.
Yeah.
It's quite a lonely experience at times. So it's amazing to sort of have that support from other people doing exactly the same thing.
And the ones that I mentioned actually, and as well as Laline, I mean, you have mother, daughter from Of Rare Origin and Miran Crosby, you have sisters, and Laline, you have best friends, and I'm sure you have a lot of support, but you're on your own. So I think that merits a lot more support too.
Well, I have an amazing team. It's definitely not that I do this alone. So I'm very thankful for my team, and you know, our customers also are just incredibly supportive, and I'm eternally grateful to everyone that's helped my journey. But it's very nice to be among friends.
Georgia, where are you from?
I'm England. I was born in Cambridge. Can you hear the accent? slightly. Was born in Cambridge, and I grew up there, which was an amazing place to grow up in. I grew up on a farm, which was, you know, an incredible experience. At the time when I was growing up, I of course wanted only to be in the city, and now I'm only in the city. I long for the countryside. But it was an incredibly creative experience, actually growing up in a very rural setting next to a city that is obviously incredibly academic and historical. So I feel like I had a very nice upbringing in England, but I spent a lot of time in the USA because of my dad's heritage. So I had a really nice balance between America and England.
Were your parents professors?
No, not at all. Not at all. My father is a farmer.
Oh, and, really?
What do they
farm?
It's arable. So it's barley, wheat, that sort of thing. And my mother, actually, she is a housewife, but a kind of very avid gardener. So we always have very nice organic food at home.
How far is Cambridge from London?
It's only 1 hour. It's very close. So I was always in close proximity to, the city. And I would sort of frequently go there as much as possible. And I went to university in London as well. So I feel like I've grown up in London, really.
Growing up in Cambridge on the farm, do you think that the rural environment contributed to your creativity? And I think also you're an only child, am I right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I mean, I have an only child. They're
Oh, really?
unusual. Yeah. I mean, kind of like we were saying about the other, you know, designers with these partners, you have to really find your creativity alone, I think.
Yes. Yeah, you have to be very independent, I think, in that search for creativity. And I think it actually makes you a very resourceful person because you have to sort of find your own, I don't know, fun or your own sort of interests or your own entertainment to an extent.
Yeah.
And I think that growing up in a very rural setting adds to that because, you know, you're not surrounded by constant stimulus. You sort of
Yeah.
are kind of relatively isolated and you're with nature. And I think that for me, nature is incredibly inspiring, and it makes you very grounded, but also you can really dream of and you can be creative. You're surrounded by
For
color and
me, it was
flowers
the
and best upbringing. And also I think creating, and my mom, like I said, my mother was is an avid gardener, and I think creating something from nothing
Yeah.
also was incredibly inspiring to me as a child, and watching something grow and develop and change. And yeah, so for me it was amazing. And I think being an only child has made me fiercely independent and know my own mind and sort of access my creativity and my imagination way more than if I had been surrounded by siblings,
Siblings. Yeah.
perhaps. I mean, I was very social. I'm not some kind of recluse, but my mother made sure I was very socialized. I always had
Yeah.
friends around, and all my friends were boys, so I was a real tomboy. But yeah, in the sort of, you know, when friends go home, you have to have that time alone.
Well, I was going to say, I have noticed that in my daughter that she definitely is social, but she really needs recovery time, especially when we're around her cousins and these loud sort of families that, you know, it's just like, we're a quiet house. I mean, it just,
Yes.
and there is time for reflection and thinking. What do you remember creating or making as a child?
One of my really fond memories actually is going to this department store with my mother. And I don't know whether this exists in the US, but I guess it does, but it's a department store that allowed you to pick a sort of dress pattern, let's say, or a shirt pattern or whatever it was. And then it's within a haberdashery section of this department store. And then you pick your fabric and you pick your buttons and you pick your whatever
Yeah.
embellishment you want to add. We used to sort of do that on a Saturday morning or something and buy a few pieces. And then we'd go home and she'd teach me to make them and customize. And it was such a wonderful thing to learn as a child. And the excitement of creating something that was very unique to me was incredible. And of course, I went wild and picked all the most awful fabrics, the most glittery things I could find. And I'm totally the opposite now, but I think I got it out of my system at a young age.
And did your mom teach you how to sew?
Yes, we actually had like a sewing room, actually, an industrial overlocker, an industrial machine. And she would always be making things, curtains, bedspreads. She made her own wedding dress. Like, she's very
Oh,
creative
wow.
in that sense. So yeah, she taught me to sew. I mean, I actually, the actual act of sewing, I don't like. I was actually pretty bad at it because I'm quite impatient, but the choosing the components and sort of
Yeah.
like, forming the piece
Yeah.
was amazing. And she would mostly sew it. I would try.
And so growing up, did you, what subjects were you attracted to? Were you mostly into art or all sorts of things?
I've always been very naturally able at art. I mean, it's been sort of easy for me to
Yeah.
draw and paint and all that stuff. But I was actually not really that interested in it. I think, you know, sometimes when something comes quite easy to you,
Yeah.
the way I work is I like to try and learn something that I'm not very good at and be able to do it. So I actually was really interested in the science world, psychology, literature, but mostly it was science that I was really focused on actually as a child. And I studied it for my A levels. I'm not sure what the equivalent of that is in the US, but I guess it's the age of like 17 to 19.
Yeah.
And sort of I guess I majored in chemistry and psychology, and
Oh, wow.
it was the path I wanted to take. I guess I found it very creative, and I loved the idea of problem solving and finding solutions to things via this medium. At the same time, I was introduced to this very inspiring art teacher who said, you know, you've got this kind of skill, why don't you be part of my class too? And so I did, and he introduced me to this textile teacher, and I would never have ever thought of you know, going into textiles, it didn't really interest me actually as a career. I met her and she was like, well, actually textiles and weaving and creating something from nothing is actually incredibly mathematical, and it has a logic to it. And actually there's a real parallel there with your kind of thought process of chemistry. And I was like, okay, let me give this a go. And I ended up finding these parallels with chemistry and art that for me, it was just this unlock. And I was like, oh my goodness, if I can apply this sort of more scientific logic and problem solving to textiles and fashion, that's something that I could really, really be inspired by and go forward with that. And actually, that's what I decided to do. And I ended up quitting chemistry and psychology. I still love psychology, actually. But
yeah, I was going to say, you're in fashion, you're doing psychology.
Yeah, exactly. Every day to myself as well. But the idea for me of problem solving and applying something that you know is not just artistic to fashion, but actually comes from a different place, and fusing it with fashion, like style and function, is something I'm really, really fascinated by. Was the path I decided to take from this kind of change and fork I had in my schooling. So yeah, I went full steam ahead into fashion actually from the age of 18.
Were your parents like, what's happening?
Yeah. They just went with it. They were like, okay. I think my mom was actually pretty pleased.
And so you went to London and studied fashion there.
Yeah, I did a work placement at Zandra Rhodes actually.
Oh my God.
Crazy pink hair. Like, I mean, it was incredible. It was all in her house. There was prints everywhere. It was like this. I had never experienced anything like this. I was 17 or 18, and I was just like, wow, I just want to be part of this world. There was just like this magic and this alchemy. And I was like, okay, so it wasn't my taste actually, but I was like, this process was incredible to me.
Yeah.
So that was the moment I decided to move to London. That was kind of my test. I think it was my parents pushing me to test it before I
completely
changed career.
Yeah.
but I loved it. I was completely immersed in this world, and I was like, I want to be part of this world. And so, yeah, I studied in London. I studied at London College of Fashion, and then I went on to study menswear at Middlesex University, which was at the time a very good university for menswear design.
And why menswear? How did that happen from Zandra Rhodes to menswear?
Yeah, exactly. That's not really any parallel opposite. With that. I think it's because for me, the Zandra Rhodes experience was amazing, but it really showed me that I didn't want to do that. It was just creativity everywhere. There was artistry everywhere. But for me, I like a much more logical framework, and I wanted to kind of find my niche in fashion, because the fashion world is huge. And, you know, for me, menswear was really a craft, and it was really a kind of framework, and you had parameters and you have boundaries. But for me, it was exciting to try and figure out how to innovate within those boundaries.
And there definitely are rules.
Yeah, there are rules. Yeah. Whereas women's wear, it actually frightened me a bit, because I was like, well, you could literally do anything, and I don't really know where to start. I'm sort of very menswear in my look. And so I really enjoyed the challenge of learning something really thoroughly and then being able to find innovation within that framework. I always call it my education. I got a job at Burberry in London. I was there for 7 years. For me, it was my education, and it really taught me, well, it taught me heritage. Like at the time, the company was 150 years old. So it was pretty amazing to me to see this all the history and heritage of that company, but how they were taking it forward into the future. And I was there at a very interesting time. It was 2005 that I joined through 7 years later I left. But through that period, it was when they were really the pioneers of fusing fashion and technology. And that was something that, you know, all the big luxury brands, they were sort of archaic in their mentality, in a sense, whereas Christopher Bailey at Burberry was pioneering this kind of digital age within fashion, whereas everyone else was sort of rebelling against it, or repelling it actually. So yeah, it was an amazing time. And I think, again, it played to my interests in like how to kind of innovate and how to kind of push something and solve something. And you know, for me, it was a really eye-opening experience.
Well, and Christopher was a fascinating creature too, because he became not only the designer, but he really spearheaded the entire, he became the CEO, I think, didn't he, at some point? Yeah.
Yes. And I think to have that sort of duality in your brain and your way of operating is something that I feel that I really took from that experience. And I think I have a sort of duality in my way I think, and the product I produce has a real duality, but I really sort of looked up to his approach, rather than just sort of, you know, making beautiful things for people that just want to kind of buy something that's quite elaborate and statement. He was actually thinking about things for a different reason, and I really looked up to that.
Technical also. I mean, it was like waterproof, you mean? And
yeah, on the product level, the fact that the product was had both style and function, which is something that I really sort of lead my company with that mantra. But also the fact that you could take fashion and you could, I mean, he was the first person to ever sort of do a hologram runway. And
I remember that. A live runway stream, you could buy
from the runway live, and like all of these things that you can make possible, but they weren't the status quo. You know, they weren't the way to do it. And I love that kind of rule breaking. In reality, it's to help a customer, and it's to kind of give a customer a better experience. That's ultimately what he was doing, and that's what I really, really took from that experience. Do it in my own little way.
Well, I mean, I think he was way ahead of his time, and also like Instagram and TikTok or whatever, that didn't exist at that time.
For sure.
You know, and so I think that you have different tools now in order to do that.
Yes, and I think he was he was very resourceful and industrious with what he had at the time, and it was very interesting to work in the design team at this time, because he always tried to bring in like music and art, and it wasn't just fashion, and that's something that was even more inspiring to me, the fact that it created a world rather than just a category.
Yeah. So how did you know it was time to leave?
I think I'd been there quite a long time. I'd been there for just over 7 years.
For seven, in fashion, 7 years is like 70 years.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I was sort of a pensioner of fashion at that time. I was like, okay, I've really got to go. I think it was because I felt like I really had accomplished what I set out to do. And I really felt like I knew a lot about, I mean, of course you never know everything, and I'm learning every single day and every single second, but I really felt that at that company, at that moment, I felt like I'd really absorbed so much and I was ready for something new. And I really like to challenge myself as much as I can. I think it's just my inner personality wanting to learn and develop. And so I actually took a trip to New York. It wasn't to explore work opportunities, but I just took a trip to New York because I love New York. And I happened to meet, I actually can't remember how I did it, but I happened to meet somebody that said, you should meet the guys at Rag & Bone.
Right.
And so I ended up saying, oh, actually I'm in town. Like, you know, I'm sort of looking for something new. Do you want to meet? I also met with the RRL team at Ralph. They wanted me to join their team. And I actually felt like I loved RRL at the time, but I just felt maybe it was a bit limiting. It was like just working with vintage and replicating. Whereas when I met the guys at Rag & Bone, it was an amazing time for them. And it was like really growing. And they were just like, oh, we just need kind of some experience and we need some help. And they were like, we could kind of do anything and everything. And I just thought, okay, whoa, I want to be part of that. Because I've been 7 years in a very sort of, you know, corporate established company. Yeah. And this just felt very exciting to me. So I started as head of menswear at Rag & Bone.
Oh, wow.
I was then head of women's and men's and denim and, you know.
And so when you moved to women's, that was your first time working on women's wear. Yeah, was it completely different?
Totally different. It was something that I didn't set out to do, actually. I was only wanting to be a menswear designer. I just loved menswear. But I saw that at that particular company, the roots was really like the own Marcus, who was my boss, he was just obsessed with menswear too. And I just thought the women's wear should have more of this androgynous kind of, you know, feel. And so I thought it was a natural way to kind of try women's wear. And so I kind of headed up both departments, and there was, you know, a great crossover between the two, having one leader, I guess. So yeah, it was actually a really nice way to get into women's wear because it was based around menswear.
Exactly. It was sort of menswear, women's wear.
Exactly.
And you were living in the States at the time for when
yeah.
you
and yeah.
what was so and what was that like? Did you travel all over?
Yes. Yes. I've traveled all over. I've tried to take advantage of the fact of living in the US. I think I was there again 7 years. So it was again a really nice length of time for me to be in New York. And I took as many trips as possible. And I mean, I love America. I just think it's such a fascinating country. It's so huge and vast and everything is
so huge.
Different. Yeah. Everywhere you go, it's just totally different. And I really love the kind of entrepreneurial spirit that everyone seems to have in the US. In the UK, it's very different. But in the US, yeah, everyone is just so encouraging and supportive. And yeah, I love coming here. So when I lived there, I took as many trips to different states as I could to try and get a, you know, lay of the land.
What trips blew your mind the most?
I mean, to be very obvious here, I'm going to say that my trip to Marfa.
Yeah. yeah.
I mean, I took many, many trips that were amazing, but one that really stood out to me was my trip to Marfa in Texas. And I did it with a friend of mine, and it was in 2016 that I took the trip. And we sort of did a bit of a road trip. You know, we drove around Texas a little bit and ended up in Marfa. And it was the time in my career that I was thinking about what my next step was. And yeah. should I do something that's for myself that I, it's purely my vision, something that I truly believe in. And I was sort of toying with the idea because I traveled a lot, not just within the US, but I traveled back to the UK a lot, to Asia, all over the world. And I'd probably travel at least once a month. For me, that was a real problem because yeah. I couldn't pack efficiently. I didn't want to take 100 different things that did 100 different jobs. When you're traveling across different climates and seasons in, you know, if you're going from the US, I don't know, from Arizona where it's really hot and you're going to, I don't know, Scotland where it's raining and freezing. I was like, how can I pack for all of these things? And especially when you're stopping off at different things along the way. And also, how do you go through with hand luggage?
Yeah.
Because like immigration in the US took hours. So I was toying with this, like this problem that I had actually as a customer. And I was just thinking to myself, like, how do I create something that, because there is a gap in the market for women. I was just like, yeah. It was clear to me, having worked in menswear for so long, having been newly introduced to working in women's wear, there's a real problem. It's either fashion or it's function.
Right.
And it's just, there's so much kind of sort of theater and drama behind women's wear, but was anyone thinking about the customer? And so I was just like, I was toying with all of these ideas. And I was like, I just need something that I could kind of, that could be multifunctional, that could be adapted across different temperatures and different sort of environments and also occasions. Like you want to pack for different occasions. If you have a dinner, maybe you're hiking, I don't know, whatever you're doing. And so anyway, long-winded story, sorry Laura.
No.
I went to Marfa with a friend of mine, and I had all these ideas and sort of questions going through my head. And the reason we went to Marfa was because I'm a huge fan of Donald Judd's work and process. It's not
and,
just
and you'd
work.
Been to you'd been to his apartment or his building in
yes in New
Soho.
York.
Yeah,
yes, exactly. And I used to always go to Dia Beacon and, you know, yeah. all of those kind of guys with the Dan Flavin and yeah. Richard Serra. And I was a real fan of the kind of, you know, minimalist modernist movement of US American artists. And so Marfa was kind of this fun trip that me and my friend wanted to take, and I was just very intrigued to do this sort of pilgrimage to Judd's process, because he's incredibly prolific across writing, across sculpture, across woodcutting, across furniture. And the product of his work is not always I don't always love it, but I love the kind of reductive and the sort of simple outcome of all of his different mediums, I suppose. And so I was standing in his architecture studio and looking at one of his desks that were just absolutely beautiful, understated, really clean lines, really beautifully executed and simplified. But I kind of looked underneath, and there are all of these hidden compartments that were not visible just from, you know, the outside. And so I just had this like very strange feeling. And it was like this weird, like burning that went through my stomach into my the head. And I was just like, oh my God, I need to create a product that is this, but in clothing, that is completely multifunctional, that looks very sort of simple and clean and minimal and reductive, but beautiful, but that I could actually, as a customer, adapt to whatever I wanted to do. Like, for example, this desk, you could put stuff all over, but then you could tidy it up and you could hide something there and you could pull this thing out and do that. And I was just like, I need products to do that for me. And I just was like, I am going to do this brand. And I just, for some reason.
Did you know it was jackets? I mean, were you that clear?
It was because I love outerwear. I think it was for me, because Martha Stance is a concept. It's not a fashion brand for me. It's a design concept. It's a way of introducing something to your lifestyle that you can build, adapt. Well, this is our tagline, essentially: create, update, renew. So you create it yourself, you update it when you want to, you know, go to a different climate or activity, and then you renew it through the rest of your life by changing it up and adding different things to it and reversing it and all that stuff.
Which, by the way, is like a completely revolutionary idea in fashion. And I can tell you, like, I remember when Elbaz, I remember seeing him speak about a collection, 10, 15 years ago. We got to sneak in and watch his talk to the team about the sales team. And he said, you know, every single piece here is meant to go with the last five seasons of work. I mean, that's what this is. And it was the most like mind-blowing thing, because nobody thinks that way in fashion. You know, it's kind of like clear out everything from last year and let's start over. You know?
Exactly.
And it's so wrong, you know?
It's so wrong. And just by working for different brands, seeing that seasonal collection after seasonal collection, that kind of, and by the time I left New York, we were doing like eight seasons or something each year.
I know.
And I think I was just like, this is just like ludicrous.
What are we even designing
are we doing? Yeah, I didn't even know what I was designing anymore. I was like, I just don't even like anything, because I just don't even know what, I can't even think. And so for me, like, this whole Martha experience of taking, and this is what I loved about who Judd was, he took himself out of the circuit and he just took himself to this remote destination and created this community based around something that he truly believed in and was incredibly prolific by being in those conditions. And I think that I wanted to take myself out of this kind of, you know, fashion world and just create something that was completely different, that was based around the idea of renewing a piece, creating a piece yourself, expressing your own identity, not what the designer wants to do. It's exactly what the customer wants. Creating this kind of blank canvas for a customer to adapt the piece for whoever they are and wherever they go, not just for the season and what the trend is. Like, for me, that's just completely, it's not relevant. So I wanted to create something that was truly relevant to people's lifestyles. And for me I went to Italy, I went to my factories that I used to work with, and I said, look, this is not going to be easy because it's not the normal way of doing things. There's going to be no seasons. Everything's seasonless. Everything can be built up for winter and stripped back down for spring. The calendar, we're not going to have a calendar. It's going to be when we need to add things, we're going to add things. When we need to develop things, we're going to develop things. And it's going to be a collection of continuity, in the sense that the same things that I launched with you now, this was in 2018, we're going to be making these in 2028.
Right.
You know, it's the same. It doesn't change. What changes is the accessory, so that people can keep switching it up. We're going to add new things, of course, but the new things complement the original things. And so you can wear them together. It's a collection of, it's a circular collection in that sense. And also what I was very, very focused on creating was a company which also was responsible. So I wanted to be responsible for all of the fabrics. So our fabrics, we use them up every season by doing patchwork styles. So you'll see quite a lot of color blocking and sort of patchworking in our collection. It's because at the end of our kind of production run, we then take the fabrics and then we reuse them. So we never have any waste. It's a zero waste brand, like
that's
zero.
That's insane.
Zero. And for me, I also go to the factories and I find, and it's funny you mentioned Lanvin there, because actually our new Shearling collar color is this pale blue, and it was left over from a Lanvin production from 3 years ago. And I just saw this box. I was like, what's in that box? And they were like, oh, it's just, you know, leftover. We're going to throw it away. And I was like, nope. So now it's become our best selling color. And
we've oh my God. Sold
out. So we make these things now that are collectible because there's a finite amount of them.
Yeah.
To answer your initial question of what was the most horrible trip you ever took, I've got to say it's Marfa, because it completely inspired me to change my life, jump off the merry-go-round that I was on, move back to London and start again, essentially. Self-funded on my own. That was the biggest risk of my life. So I either was going to totally blame Donald Judd for everything or thank him for everything.
Well, and how long after that trip did you actually move back to England?
It was probably about 18 months later. Uh-huh. I gave actually a 12-month notice period. I think I quit in 2017. I left in 2018, right at the beginning of 2018. And then I took the year to develop the brand, actually. So I didn't launch until kind of midway through 2019. But I took a year and a bit to kind of really, really have a laser focused vision on what I wanted to do without being influenced by anyone else. Just really what the world doesn't need another fashion brand. So how can I create something that actually is genuinely needed? And I just felt like in the women's wear space, in the luxury women's wear space, this concept was needed. And we are validated every day.
Exactly. Well, and the thing I think that is really interesting about it, I think I've just come back from market, and you know, we have 8 or 10 appointments a day, and you have a salesperson from a brand in Milan who is Brazilian, you know, saying these are our best-selling things. You definitely need to add this to your buy. And you just are like, I live in North Carolina. You have no idea what my climate is like. You have no idea who my clients are. Yeah. You have no idea what their lifestyle is and what they do. And I think that it is extremely unusual to give the power of that to the client and to say, like, I mean, and even thinking, you know, thinking about your trip to Marfa, I'm like, I don't even know what the climate is like in Marfa. I don't even know what you would pack for Marfa.
Exactly. I didn't know either.
But a client will know that, and a client will know,
exactly.
You know, this is where I'm going. This is how I feel on airplanes. This is what I'm going to want.
Exactly.
I'm a hiker. I'm not a hiker. I need to go out to dinner. I mean, all the things. And it's totally in the control of the client.
Exactly. And this is why I love doing these trunk shows.
Yeah.
Because I get to go around the US in particular, because the US is actually 65% of our business, wow, which is massive. I didn't really know how that happened, but it happened totally organically.
Well, let's go back to when you left Rag & Bone and you moved back to Great Britain. And did you have a mentor? Did you talk to people about doing this? And you said it's self-funded. I mean, tell me how you did that. I mean, how did you figure that out?
I sort of shut my eyes and just, I think I thought I was, you know, everyone thought I was a bit nuts. You know, sometimes when you just have this itch and you just have to, you sort of become a little blinkered. And even though, you know, people were telling me don't do it, it's really difficult. I mean, people were telling me don't do it out of pure love, not to sort of, not from a competitive, like, you know.
We don't want to see you get hurt.
Yeah, it was purely to protect me. And I can't tell you the number of people that were just, you know, really honest and just like, look, you're a great designer, but you've never run a business before. Like, it's a really tough, it's a really tough market out there. It's a tough world. Don't do it. I think when someone tells me don't do it or you can't do it, it makes me want to do it more. So I think for me, it was actually the best thing for people to have said, because I really knew that this was needed. It wasn't, if I was just going to create something that, you know, already existed, then yes, that feedback was fully valid and they were right. But I think because I knew this was something that didn't exist in the market and that was really needed, and that people's mentality and they really wanted to, like, kind of live in a more responsible and conscious way. Mm-hmm. I think, well, I suppose that happened actually during the pandemic. That hadn't really happened yet when I launched the brand, but people were starting to think more in that way in 2018. So anyway, I decided that I wasn't going to listen and I was going to do it. And I just said to my partner, who you know, without his, you know, support, I wouldn't have been able to do it. He said, you know, look, if you've got to do this, you've got to do this. I'll support you. You know, you don't have to, you know, I'll cover the mortgage, like all that. Just do it. So I was like, okay, I have the sort of, you know, the foundation to be able to do this. I'd worked incredibly hard to financially be able to do this. And I saved up all my money. It was my own money. I was like, okay, what am I going to do with this? This is what I really want to do. I really have this strong feeling. I'm just going to take this risk. And the founder of Olibar Brown was Adam Brown. He was a very, very, very helpful mentor in the early days. My partner at the time was designing for him. And so he was very, very kind in offering me some really good advice. And one thing that he said to me that was a piece of advice I always remember, he was like, you are no longer a designer, you are a salesperson. And I was like, what? I didn't really understand what he meant. Now I 100% understand what he meant. I am no longer a designer. I sell. This is what I do. This is my brand.
Well,
I really,
well, because that's the ultimate goal, right?
Well, if I don't have any customers, I don't have any
exactly.
brand. So for me, and I believe in this concept so much. I live by this concept that I want to show other people like that actually it's so much better for your life. So you can have less but do more with it and travel. And and you can also have these pieces that are like super special and you're helping fund these amazing communities in Italy. And like,
yeah,
you know, we're really, I hope, trying to do, you know, really good stuff. So anyway, I'm hyper passionate about it. So for me, this, it's not even selling. It's just like trying to tell everyone.
It's sharing, really.
It's sharing. Yeah. So anyway, so he was really helpful. You know, he gave me a couple of really great meetings and, you know, very generous with his time. And he kind of gave me some, you know, ideas of how to kind of stay sane. And
what were those? I'd love to know that. And then you started with e-com.
Yes, I was very, very, very clear that I wanted to be a direct consumer brand. I'd been at companies that were mostly sort of wholesale led.
Yeah.
For me, being on my own, it was incredibly important to reach the customer myself and to talk to the customer myself and to have this laser focus of what the brand is without somebody else's cadence of what sold better in their store and like blah, blah.
Yeah.
I really, really, really wanted to start direct. And I think for me, it was the right thing to do because it really authentically and organically grew my brand in these communities that are loyal supporters of Marc Fossance. And I think if I hadn't taken that route, it wouldn't have grown like this in this way. But probably after maybe 18 months, I wanted to partner with a very selective set of partners that could really understand the brand and really celebrate the brand and really introduce the brand in the right way to their communities and their networks. So 18 months in, I started to sell to a very few boutique stores around the world. The first stores were in South Korea, Japan, a few in Europe, and Net-a-Porter and Matches. They were the first like group. I still live by the same principle that I want to work with key partners that really can educate the consumer on this concept, not just to buy clothes. And Laura, you are the only stockist in the whole of the USA. And that
Thank
is intentional.
You.
That is intentional because I believe that you and your, I absolutely love what you do. And I believe that you are the right partner to tell your network and community about Marc Fossance in the right way. And I think that I'm incredibly happy and supportive of what you do as well. So I think
thank you. Well, it seems to work because we have no more inventory. We've sold.
Oh, really? Okay, great.
So I'm glad you're coming for the trunk show. But thank you. That means the world and I appreciate it so much. What has been the most meaningful part of the journey so far?
I think for me, it's our customers. It's so meaningful to me to see people really wear Marc Fossance and really love wearing Marc Fossance and really living by the concept. I love it when people send me pictures of their suitcase and they've got one piece, five collars, three hoods, a liner, and a parka, and that This is all they packed. And they're going for like a month to, I don't know, wherever they're going.
Yeah.
And they really live it. That's all they take. Plus, I don't know, the t-shirts, shirts, jeans, whatever. But in terms of an outerwear offering, that's all they need. And they can go across all these different places within 1 month. And they are like, this is great. This is exactly all I need. So for me, that is the most meaningful thing. And it's also the validation and the acknowledgement from people when they then recommend via word of mouth to their friends. This is for me the most, I have so much gratitude for everyone that has done that. And so many people do that. I think our business has grown strong in an authentic and genuine way, strongly through the word of mouth.
Yeah, no bots here. These are real people.
They're real. Like I really, really wanted to not pay. I mean, we don't pay influencers. We don't do any of that stuff. It's not what I believe in. For me, it's so sincere when actually it's customers really telling their friends. And then somebody sees somebody wearing it and stops them in the street and says, "Where's that from?" And they say, "Oh, it's this brand from the UK. And like, you should check them out." And we have so many wonderful customers that are just so incredibly supportive. And for me, that's the most meaningful thing. Everyone looks great in everything too, I've got to say. And that's also really very validating. And it's something that, when we launch a new, product, I'm actually wearing our new sweater that, you take the neck off, can take the sleeves off. It can be five different things. When people start to kind of collect from us and they're like, "Oh, we've just brought out this sweater. There's not many pieces they collect in the bag," and, all this kind of thing. So for me, that's the most amazing thing. And I love what's happening right now, especially in the US, where people are actually inviting us into their home to host an event with us. And for me, that's just, it couldn't get more meaningful than that.
Agreed. Did you ever feel like you had gone in the wrong direction? Were there ever times when you thought, "What have I done?"
I mean, honestly, no. I think from a product perspective, I'm very clear on what I want to design and what I want to produce. And it doesn't happen that often because I don't think it's needed. When it's needed, I of course do it. We're actually just launching a waterproof raincoat and waterproof hood, because I think that was missing from our collection, something fully waterproof. But no, I mean, it was a tricky journey, Laura, because, I launched it sort of late in 2019, and the pandemic happened early 2020. So I really haven't had time to make that many mistakes in a catastrophic way, because there's been all these crazy world situations like Brexit and the pandemic that have kind of distracted me somewhat.
But also, I think weirdly, like, that also gave you an audience that was not distracted by other things.
Exactly. I mean, not to be in any way insensitive, the pandemic actually helped us be more meaningful to the community that were interested in Marfasance. And it also gave us more time to be able to connect and really interact. So that I have, that I have some moments within the pandemic that, of course, I was thinking, "What on earth have I done? And how on earth am I going to, get out of this situation?" But for the most part, it was actually a really incredible time for us. And in the sense that we were really connecting with our customers in a way that perhaps we wouldn't have been able to do if there wasn't a pandemic, because we would have been running. And I think it made also, it really reinforced actually what we were trying to do. And I had created the company with this stance in mind of responsible living, buying less, but buying things that do more for you, giving back to a community. Like, we always, like, even before the pandemic, we were doing, we always do a sort of each month a donation to some organization that we're promoting on our end. And whenever we do a pop-up within the local community, we do a give back. So we were already doing this before the pandemic happened. And I think when the pandemic happened, people really had this mindset shift of, we want to be better humans. And I think that what we were trying to do was really resonated with a lot of people. And I think a lot of people really wanted to support, young brands, particularly ones that had just launched. So there was a real sense of support from people. And particularly being a female founder, I think that there was a lot of women in our kind of network that really wanted the brand to you know, succeed. So,
well, and I think ultimately too, just the product itself is comforting, and it,
yes,
and it's soft and it's light and it feels like a baby, yes, blanket, and it feels, it's, yes, lovable. It's really lovable.
Yes. Yeah. And
you know,
also,
I mean, that's the
really cool in it. You know, yeah, they weren't just like walking around, because all you do is walk around the park with your dog.
Exactly.
So I think people really wanted to like have a kind of cool coat that.
Do you have any recommendations for young entrepreneurs or people that want to start a business and don't know how?
I mean, I have probably, if you have, you got 5 hours, I can give you some advice over the course of 5 hours and some pitfalls over the course of 5 hours. But, I mean, I would say it's a tricky one to kind of advise people, because every journey is so different. And I think that, you know, you this is something, another piece of advice someone gave me, that, you know, really don't follow anyone else's path. You've got to really follow your own. And that's easier said than done. That's, you know, that sort of, it's very scary to do this. And I think it's a very brave thing and a courageous thing if you do decide to do it. And it's easy to look around at what other people are doing and get, you know, panicked and want to just follow their path. But I think you've got to be incredibly confident about your idea or what it is you want to create. And you've just got to stick by it, and you've got to have a laser focus, and you've got to just not be influenced by anything else. And you've just got to figure out how to be very consistent and very clear with your messaging of whatever you want to produce and create. And building a business, you have to be aware that there's an incredible amount of sacrifice, and the commitment is extreme. And I think if you're not prepared for that, then it's not going to work. But I think you just have to wear every hat. You have to suddenly be a salesperson. You have to be the financial director. You have to be the HR representative. You have to be the shipping expert.
Yeah.
Or not in my case, but the shipping person. You have to just be able to adapt and problem solve. I think that's my biggest piece of advice to anyone. Find creativity and problem solving.
Well, and I think, Georgia, you seem like you were sort of born as a problem solver and that sort of person. But I also think it's interesting that it sounds like all of your experiences before this really coalesced to enable you, yes, to do this, you know? And I think that young people especially forget that even bad experiences or so-so experiences really push you further on your path to what it is you really, sure, should be doing.
Absolutely. And I think if you don't kind of, you know, go through and make mistakes throughout your life, you're never going to know what is the right path. And I think that there's success in failure. I know that's sort of,
yeah,
doesn't,
yeah,
make any sense, but there really is. And I think, I really believe that. And I think that, you know, you be prepared to fail. And I think it's, yeah, it feels good sometimes to make a mistake and really learn from it. I mean, you don't want to make too many, but, but I think it's sometimes good to make some. And yeah, I think it's just how you deal with the repercussions is what makes you stronger.
The podcast is called What We Wore, and we ask everybody on the podcast what they wore to the prom. And I know they didn't have proms in Cambridge. Do you have a favorite? Well, do you have a favorite dress you've worn, or something you've worn, jacket, or do you have a favorite piece that you've made?
I think, or
a place when you felt your best, you felt your prom best.
Oh my goodness. All I can think of is the worst things. I can tell you, like, well, I'll tell you one best and one worst. We in Cambridge, actually, we did have, because I went to school in Cambridge, and we had the kind of, it's called the May Ball. It's, I guess, it's the equivalent of the prom. And I thought I was really cool to go to the vintage shop and get this like vintage Vivienne Westwood,
ooh, thing.
It was, no, it's not ooh, unfortunately. It should have been ooh. But actually, I just thought I was just very cool, and it was just so not me. And it had these, like, it was the same color as, like, I don't know, you know, a Band-Aid. It was kind of like that strange, like, funny pinky color.
Okay.
Iridescent. And it ruched skin tight.
So you, like, look nude.
So that's, I just looked nude with loads of, like, ruchy, rolly, kind of, I don't know, like, lumpy, bumpy things, these big gloves. So I thought I was being, like, very sort of ball ready, but just I really did not nail it. And I turned up, and you know when everyone's in these beautiful gowns and looking so elegant, and I just came in looking like, I mean, yeah, I just got quite drunk. And,
and did your parents, what did your parents say when you were getting ready to leave? They were like,
my mom was, you know, she was just like, what, you look like a total steak. What are you doing? And that made me want to do it. Because I was like, oh, she just doesn't understand. It's Vivian Westwood. I was being awesome. All punk, and yeah, it didn't work at all. So hence I have no photos of that night. I hope no one else does.
Exactly. We're going to check.
Yeah. Oh,
God. I love that. Thank you, Georgia.
Thank you very much for everyone.
What We Wore is produced by Capital and Balto Creative Media. The original song, Someone So Enchanting, was composed and performed by Britt Drazda. QueenCityPodcastNetwork.com.